Psychopaths are social predators who charm, manipulate, and ruthlessly plow their way through life, leaving a broad trail of broken hearts, shattered expectations, and empty wallets. Completely lacking in conscience and in feelings for others, they selfishly take what they want and do as they please, violating social norms and expectations without the slightest sense of guilt or regret. So writes Robert Hare. Say the word psychopath, and many people picture a serial killer without remorse. But what do we really know about psychopaths and how they differ from others? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What causes someone to engage in psychopathic behavior? Is it the result of a bad environment or a genetic difference? Are psychopaths so impervious to treatment that they should be locked up forever? Our two guests today from UW-Madison have initiated a unique collaboration in which they use modern brain imaging techniques in state correctional facilities to identify the neurobiological anomalies associated with psychopathy. Dr. Joseph Newman is a clinical psychologist who has been studying psychopathic criminals for over 30 years. Dr. Michael Koenigs is a neuroscientist who studies the brain circuits involved in emotion, social behavior, and decision-making. Their studies of MRIs of inmates from Wisconsin prisons have led to new evidence of the physical basis for psychopathic behavior.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks.
Thanks for having
us. Glad to be here.
Does a psychopath, as that quotation implied, have to do damage to others, or it can be just sort of a form of compulsive behavior? I mean, I think of, you know, Imelda Marcos going out and buying 3,000 pairs of shoes. She didn't really harm anybody, but it was definitely abnormal self-driven behavior.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think the answer is no, it doesn't have to harm someone. And in fact, one of the most overlooked facts in this whole field is that the behavior of psychopathic individuals is as personally costly as it is socially costly. Really, they're the number one victim of their own behavior. They lack insight. They do things without thinking, and the consequences are terrible. They can cause them to lose their freedom. They can cause them to be hurt seriously in accidents and ultimately culminate in death.
Is it just a matter of losing track of the connection between cause and effect, action and reaction?
I think in terms of the way they evaluate their own behavior is the question you're asking. I think, again, that's a good question. It's probably the hallmark of the disorder that they don't automatically realize the consequences of their action. So people often say they act without thinking. That's true. But even for the rest of us, when we contemplate some action, we automatically understand the implications of that action and where it's leading. And people with psychopathy seem to have a disconnect that causes them to be oblivious to those consequences or where those actions might be leading.
Well, let's get a good definition, because there's a lot of other sort of disorders like antisocial behavior or other mental illnesses. What do you have to do to earn the label of psychopath?
Yeah. I mean, you began with a quote by Robert Hare, and I think there's no doubt that he's been the leader in the field now for decades and has written some of the most authoritative work and also developed the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, which is considered the gold standard for measuring psychopathy.
Are you going to give us the checklist so we can put it on our kitchen wall?
Right. You can do the self-rating and rate your spouse, rate your friends. But, you know, I think when, you know, today we've benefited so much from having this very good operational definition of psychopathy that comes from the checklist, that, you know, the way we define it is predicated on that. So within the checklist, there are interpersonal symptoms, which means that when you act, you do so really to your own benefit and without really considering the needs and rights of others. There's an affective component to the definition of psychopathy, which means that you don't feel things as deeply. It's more of a shallow affect that you experience. There's a behavioral impulsivity component, which is that you're impulsive and you're irresponsible. You act without thinking. You don't follow through on commitments that you've made. And then there's an antisocial lifestyle component, which is that you never really get on track in terms of planning and doing what's socially expected. So those would be the four major components of psychopathy. I think with regard to definition, I'd like to elaborate further. You mentioned antisocial personality disorder. That is the official DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, actual category here. There is no formal diagnostic category for psychopathy. The difference between antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy is that antisocial personality disorder is much more generic. If you have a problem of engaging in antisocial behavior, we call it conduct disorder, in children, and then that persists into adulthood where you don't have a normal job and you start fights and you are arrested for some sort of illegal behavior, that would be sufficient to get you a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder. But that doesn't say anything about the reasons or the causes. It could be biological. It could be social. It could be that you're emotionally too reactive or unreactive. And so it doesn't seem very useful in terms of understanding who it is we're talking about or what the needs of those people might be. And then there's one other concept I'd like to introduce, the concept of sociopathy, that people often ask, what's the difference between psychopathy and sociopathy? Are they just the same thing? Today, we use sociopathy to talk about a person with biologically normal temperament. So they have the equipment to be completely normal, but they grow up in an environment where the opportunity for socialization is somehow distorted. So either their parents are not really taking their responsibility sufficiently seriously and they're not conferring the rules of society, or they're interacting almost entirely with people who are members of gangs, and there's a whole alternative socialization. So they'll learn that socialization that's presented to them in the environment, but it will be one that's antisocial. So they're not distinct. And now we can understand psychopathy as something more specific. It's assumed to be a biological predisposition to a failure of socialization. These are people who are unsocialized, as you said, in terms of the way they deal with society and other people or planning. But it's not due to their environment. It's not due to lack of intelligence or ability. It's not because they're particularly emotionally reactive. In fact, it's the opposite. They don't seem to be sensitive to cues in their environment that the rest of us would use to regulate their behavior.
And we'd say it's how they're wired, which kind of brings me to the neuroscience part of this. I mean, is your interest in this collaborative project, Mike, something about wiring? I realize is not a good technical term, but is it in looking at the differences then that are in the brain?
Exactly. So, I mean, the logic or the rationale for the brain imaging component of this is that the very striking personality and behavioral differences that Joe was describing must be underpinned by some differences in the neural circuitry that underlies critical domains of function that we're talking about. So social behavior, the ability to generate and regulate emotion, sensitivity to reward and punishment. So the aim of the imaging component here is to identify, to look in those neural circuits that we know to be important in subserving these functions that we think are related to psychopathy.
And how do you track that? What kind of a stimulus would you use to track the response through the brain?
Well, there's two ways we can do this study. So one, as you're suggesting, is we can use a stimulus. So while we have in this case, an inmate in the MRI scanner, we can show them pictures to trigger areas of the brain that we think might be important for psychopathy. So we, for example, we had one study where we showed them sort of a gambling or slot machine game where in some cases they were expecting reward and won reward. In some cases they might have been expecting reward and lost, right? And so we can see how those areas of the brain that we know to be important for responding to reward, whether they might be functioning differently in psychopathy. Another thing we can do, so there's an old idiom in neuroscience dating back decades that says, what fires together wires together. And so that is those tracts of your brain that are most commonly activated or most commonly used, you will actually see in the structure of the brain a reflection that that particular area is either overdeveloped or underdeveloped, or that two areas of the brain are able to work together more efficiently or not.
The London cab drivers were a prime study for that, where they find that part of the brain has to do with spatial reasoning and, I guess, map use and everything much more highly developed than the general population.
That's exactly right. That's a perfect example. I mean, another example is if you look at an expert pianist. So the area of the pianist's brain that controls the dexterity of the fingers is going to be better developed than in your average person. And so since we have some working hypotheses and some working models about the areas of the brain that are important for moral sensitivity, emotion regulation, that's exactly where we looked in the MRI scans of the psychopathic inmates.
Well, let me back it up before we get to the results, which I'm interested to hear about. Let's talk about the whole process of working with a prison system, because you've got so much history there of misuse of prisoners and the kind of distrust of scientific research being done within a prison system. Tell us about how the collaboration came about and how you deal with the ethics that are involved in working with, not with, you know, laboratory mice, but with people.
I think it's a great question, and it's actually a great story, too. I actually came to the University of Wisconsin in 1981, and a large factor influencing my decision was the reputation of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections, which had been a leader in North America in terms of correctional policy, and there was a very good psychological services here at the time. And I actually began my collaboration with them at that time. And what you see among the corrections workers is amazing, especially in light of the common reputation that corrections gets. I mean, here what you see is people who are really interested in understanding the problems that their inmates have so that they can deliver the best possible services for them. And then, you know, despite the fact that the systems, you know, they're overcrowded and they're underfunded, even though it takes a lot of money, and to make room for researchers to come in and use their resources and complicate their schedules is something that most prisons are not willing to do. I think also around the world, prisons aren't allowed to do it because they're afraid of people coming in and what they might see and say about what they're seeing. But these are well-run prisons, and I think they're proud to have people come in. With that opportunity, there are a lot of ethical concerns about doing research with prisoners, as you alluded to early on, and they were abused. It was the thought was, if we want to know about anatomy, well, these are people who have violated the rules of society, so we can just cut them up and learn what we want to learn or try medications on them. And it was horrible. I mean, crude experiments that were done that are really the basis for our human subjects oversight today, not to repeat any of those kinds of mistakes. Today, in order to do work in corrections, the work that you're doing has to be directly relevant to the needs of the offenders. So we demonstrate with every project that we do, we're trying to understand the causes of incarceration. What is it that's different about these offenders that made it more likely that they would end up incarcerated, and can we use that information to prevent other people from being incarcerated? So that's what makes it permissible. Also, there's a standard that you cannot do anything that's more than minimal risk. So the human subjects committees review every protocol, and they make the determination that what we're doing, whether it's brain scanning or the kinds of experiments that I do or the diagnostics that I do, that that constitutes minimal risk, nothing more than you would encounter in everyday life.
So you're saying that you can identify a psychopath by looking at the brain?
No. The way the data are now, or the level of sophistication we're at, if you were to give us a group of 40 inmates and 20 of them were psychopathic inmates and 20 were non-psychopathic inmates, and you asked me to tell you which group of 20 were which, we could do that. But we can't do that in an individual level.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the measures that we have that distinguish psychopathic inmates from non-psychopathic inmates at the group level aren't sensitive enough to be diagnostic at the level of the individual.
I don't understand that. So what are you saying? Let's say we have the 40 inmates, and you looked at the MRIs of all of them without knowing which were diagnosed in which way. You're saying you would be able to tell a difference to split that group into who was and who was not psychopathic, but
I'm saying in the hypothetical that, you know, you had 20 of each type preselected, and you gave me all the scans, that I would be able to tell you which 20 were the psychopathic and which 20 were the non-psychopathic. But for any individual, I couldn't. So one way to think about it is, let's say we have some measure of brain function X, right? And that brain function X has, in the normal population, you know, an arbitrary score of 0 to 10. So it's not that every psychopath is an 11 or more, right? So they might be 7s to 15s, but there's some overlap in there where you wouldn't be able to say this one individual is definitely one type or the other.
So we're not at the stage where we're going to do proactive prediction of behavior of a prison population.
I wouldn't necessarily say that, because right now in sentencing, risk assessment plays a huge role.
Sure.
And risk assessment works on these sort of general principles. So things like your age and your gender and your history of criminal offense and gang affiliation and substance use problems, these all factor into risk assessment. And so those aren't going to tell you necessarily what one individual is certainly has experienced or certainly will experience, but they use that as a general rule to say a person of this type is this much more likely mm-hmm. to reoffend, and that'll mm-hmm. factor into sentencing. Now, if it's the case that the brain imaging data offers some additional predictive value to those risk assessment models, it could very well be used in a proactive sense. Now, we're not there yet, but I think that is more likely to be a use in the not-so-distant future as opposed to, you know, diagnostically you are or you aren't a psychopath.
From an immediately practical standpoint, once these individuals are in prison anyway, what would the prison do differently if they identified by brain type and behavior psychopath and inclination towards psychopathy? Would they be more likely to segregate them in terms of the prison treatment of those various prisoners?
Well, immediately, nothing. And this gets to a point of rights and welfare of the participants. So one condition of the research now is that the results of our studies that we do won't in any way affect the inmate's standing in the Department of Corrections. So it's entirely isolated from how they're treated now. Do you want to say something about
that? Yeah, I think one of the things that might be important is that people with psychopathy, I think the evidence is not that strong, but they're often thought to be antisocial for different reasons and that those reasons make them somehow untreatable. And in certain places around the world, they may be denied treatment. And, you know, one of the uses of this kind of diagnostic information, as Mike said, you can't clearly or perfectly identify an individual. But if you have an idea that probabilistically this person is behaving in an antisocial way because they're psychopathic and this person's behaving that way because of their environment or because they're emotionally reactive, they may have very different treatment needs. And I think that instead of denying people treatment because they score high on a psychopathy scale, if we realize that their brains really are wired up differently, that the reasons for their antisocial behavior are different, that we might be able to develop more customized interventions that are effective for people who have this type of brain abnormality, I'll call it.
I have a question about the sort of the population of the Wisconsin prison system that you're working with. You know, you mentioned that it was in many ways well run, you know, kind of compared to some other places in the country, but it also has a record of having an incredibly bad record for disproportionately locking up African American men, for example. And, you know, you've got a lot of situations where the people who end up with long prison sentences are those without the money to pay for fancy lawyers. So what do you do in terms of the uniqueness of the population that you're looking at? And have you, as you're working on this, sort of seen evidence of injustice behind who is behind bars?
I've published a few papers on this and I'm sensitive to it. I'd like to see if we're on the same page in terms of your opening statement, which is that I think you're right that as I understand it, in the Wisconsin prison system, I think about 40% of the population is African American, whereas only about 8% of our population is. And so that sort of supports your point that it's disproportionate. But I don't see that as the prison issue. I don't know what's leading up to that incarceration. Once they're in prison, as far as I know, they're treated very similarly. Now, the question that I think flows from your premise is that, you know, are we finding the same kinds of problems in African Americans that we're finding in the European American offenders? And I think the answer is no, and let me clarify that. When we do work on psychopathy, and I have been doing this now for decades, and there's certain very key differences that are associated, behavioral differences that are associated with psychopathy in terms of how they perform emotion tasks or inhibition tasks. And we find these differences very clearly in the European American offenders. But when we look at subsamples of African American offenders, we don't replicate those findings. We don't find the same powerful statistical relationships that we find in the European Americans. And we've published these failures to replicate. I think that's very important because even if people have done crimes and are incarcerated for that reason, and even if they earn high psychopathy scores because they satisfy all the particular items on the checklist, the meaning of those high psychopathy scores might be different in the African American and the European American samples. For me, that also means that we certainly would want to take that information into account in terms of what the treatment needs are or in terms of how amenable people might be to treatment, because it seems like the processes underlying their self-regulation problems are different.
Yeah, and maybe I can just add to that. Joe, correct me if I go off the rails here, but just by the way of a more sort of specific or concrete anecdote related to what Joe was talking about, how a particular kind of inmate, so like if an African-American inmate from a slum kind of neighborhood, for anyone from a slum kind of neighborhood, for that example, could get scored in a way that is not consistent with how people from other backgrounds might be scored. So imagine someone who, a young man around the age of 13 or 14, starts, you know, leaving home and running the streets and primarily, you know, making their income from drugs and not being at school and not being at home. That person would score on the psychopathy checklist. They would score for what, irresponsible behavior and sort of impulsive behavior. So if that happens in the context of a stable, you know, middle class neighborhood, that's pathological behavior. But if that happens in the context of a slum where at home, you know, maybe mom's a prostitute and her boyfriends beat her up and beat you up and there's not really food, it's not a safe environment, you don't have your basic needs supported, well, I don't know that it's pathological that you would seek refuge from that and, mm-hmm. you know, find ways to hustle and make money however you could. But yet, those get scored.
And so to tie the two points together, the one that I made and Mike followed up on, given that those environments may sort of create a different context in which to interpret the scores, it seems meaningful that we don't see the same psychobiological correlates when we look at them in the laboratory.
So in other words, if you're looking at the way the brain reacts in the psychopath, you will see that, whatever you want to call it, enhancement in that part of the brain. Whereas if you look at somebody who simply has been through the school of hard knocks, may have behaved much the same way but wouldn't have that development?
That's a critical question, one that we're actually in the process of trying to figure out right now.
And I would think it would have some implications for the legal world as well and for treatment. We'll talk more about that when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our two guests today are Joseph Newman and Michael Koenigs, and we are talking about psychopaths. One thing that I forgot to ask is, how common is psychopathy? In other words, if you take 100 people or, you know, 1,000 people or something, how many are going to get the label of psychopaths as opposed to just some people who have some emotional problems?
Actually, it's interesting that there, because of the difficulty defining psychopathy rigorously, which I would say is you need to do something like use a Hare psychopathy checklist, but you can only use that within the prison system or else using information that lets you gauge a lot of important things about their antisocial behavior. So there's never really been a community-wide survey like there are in so many other areas. But using a variety of information, Bob Hare has estimated that about 1% of the general population would satisfy the criteria for psychopathy. And it's a pretty agreed upon estimate. If you enter a prison system, it's going to be more like 15 to 20, 25% of the male population will qualify for a diagnosis of psychopathy. In the female population, more like 6 to 15%.
6 to 15% of women. Females?
Female inmates.
Thank you. So lower.
Yeah. And okay. is there comorbidity? In other words, are you likely to find that if somebody meets the criteria for psychopathy, they also may have one or more other mental illnesses, be that schizophrenia or bipolar or depression?
Yeah, there's really
depression
nice.
Or,
there's nice research on that. And the answer is no, they're not likely to have those other disorders. The one true exception would be substance use disorders, where they are more likely to have them. And the other one is the obvious antisocial personality disorders, highly correlated with psychopathy. But no, they're not more likely to have schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, and some people have argued they're less likely to have them.
Are there substances that are likely to bring out psychopathic behavior?
Early on, people thought that alcohol was one very good substance.
Yeah, I mean, it would be your natural suspect, but
Hervey Cleckley, who probably wrote the book The Mask of Sanity, which is kind of the Bible in terms of the description of psychopathy, he argued that their behavior becomes fantastic and uninviting when they've had alcohol because it already takes their very weak inhibitions and weakens them further.
Well, can you give us some kind of basic sense of the brain differences that you're finding? I realize that it's not clear cut and that there it's sort of more of a spectrum and so on. But if you had sort of the, I don't know, a case that was really clear, mm-hmm. more so than usual, what is it that you would see that would be different in terms of the way the brain is functioning?
Well, some of the most pronounced differences that we've seen is in a circuit between the prefrontal cortex, which is the area of the brain just behind your forehead that controls planning and rational thought and executive function, and an area of the brain, an evolutionarily very old area of the brain buried deep in the brain called the amygdala. So the amygdala is sort of the fear and aggression center of your brain. Now, in a healthy individual, there's a very robust communication between those two areas of the brain, which you can imagine is adaptive. So, you know, in a healthy brain, your amygdala should respond when there's a threat in your environment or if there's some reason for you to be, you know, afraid or aggressive or what have you. And then your prefrontal cortex can provide for your amygdala some context about that, you know, like, okay, it's time to calm down or, you know, or something like that. Or
fight or flight.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, it might trigger you to seek other information in your environment, incorporate that into your subsequent behavior. So the level of communication between the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, we as in the neuroscience community in general, is a critical marker for adaptive social and emotional behavior. And so that's the circuit that we looked at in our initial MRI study of psychopathic prison inmates. And that's where we found the biggest difference between psychopathic and non-psychopathic inmates. And I should add that that's not the only difference we found, but that was the first thing, I guess, that we were
so
struck
how,
by.
So how is it different? I mean, and how would that – can you give us a sort of specific example of a case, you know, an activity where that would affect how a psychopath would respond?
So in, I guess getting to the first part of the question, more specifically about, you know, what we measure or what we look for, those two areas of the brain that I mentioned, the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala, are connected by fibers or what are known as the white matter in the brain. So these fibers are cables through which the electrical impulses that serve as the signals in your brain travel. So we do a type of MRI brain imaging that allows us to measure the structural integrity of those actual white matter fibers. And so that's one way we look to measure and identify that the psychopath's brain had to reduce communication between those areas. Another complementary approach that we used was to look at the activity of those two areas. So if you lay in the scanner with no particular task at hand, there will be these spontaneous low-frequency fluctuations of activity in areas of your brain. So your brain doesn't just go silent because you're not doing anything, but over time, the activity will wax and wane. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there's this general principle of neuronal function that what fires together wires together. So in a healthy brain, if two areas of the brain are commonly coactive and working together, you'll see that as the activity of one increases, the activity of the other increases. And over time, the signal in those two areas will be correlated. So we can also look, just as the inmates lay at rest, measuring the activity profile over time, and we can identify that those two areas of the brain seem not to be communicating in that their activity is not as correlated in the psychopathic inmates as non-psychopathic inmates. Now to get to your question about what type of circumstance would require those two areas of the brain to sort of work together and what kind of behavior might you observe if they weren't working together. So one study that was done that showed abnormal activity in the circuit, not by our lab but by a collaborator, would show subjects pictures of a scene that would be morally abhorrent to a normal person. So something like KKK with a burning cross or something like that. And the subject is asked to, you know, provide some rating or evaluation. Now there, you know, your amygdala, again, in a healthy brain, would activate and tell you there's something, you know, very wrong here, and your prefrontal cortex would supply some context for that and, you know, reaffirm that type of thought. In the case of a psychopathic inmate, that connection might not be made, and they just would not show that sensitivity at a neural level to the immoral content of that.
So that would account for the kind of dispassionate way in which psychopaths are thought to act. In other words, emotionless in terms of killing somebody.
Yeah, I wonder if I can elaborate, and correct me if I'm not getting this right, Mike. But another person in the field, James Blair, who's very interested in this kind of connectivity also, would talk about developmentally what's happening, that this connection between amygdala and prefrontal cortex that Mike talked about, that when they do fire together, there's a way in which it serves to link stimuli in the environment with this emotion response. So you learn that these people who are smiling are, you know, likely to deliver positive things, and that people who have a different look on their face are likely to be more of a concern, and that, you know, when your parent gives you that look, like, you better stop, that you know what that means, and it enhances stop. So that this connection is very important developmentally for learning cues in the environment that would guide your behavior toward things or away from things. And then James Blair has also gone on to relate this to what he calls violence inhibition, and there's as a violence inhibition mechanism. So he talks about the situation, for instance, in animals where you see two dogs fighting. When one clearly seems to become dominant and has the other one down and its mouth on the other one's throat, the other dog, the dog that the underdog, exactly, has a kind of pathetic, painful look. And that actually, because the amygdala responds to that as well, it's aversive, and you actually back off without harm being done intraspecies that way. And that he argues that without this connectivity and with this kind of, I mean, he sees it as amygdala-driven problem, that you wouldn't have that violence inhibition mechanism working in psychopathy.
And I guess we would almost think of that as a lack of conscience if you don't have it. I mean, we're not sure scientifically what a conscience is, but you're talking in part about the moral perception of right and wrong.
Right. And I guess I would like to just elaborate that on. I think what Mike talked about first in terms of your response to those moral issues is probably more like conscience, whereas the example that I gave about the violence inhibition is so much more specific. But I think that distinction is a very interesting and an important one. The people in the field who believe that people with psychopathy are simply fearless, and that explains everything that they do, I think are saying that, you know, with that one deficit, you can explain the lack of conscience. I'm skeptical of that interpretation. I think it's overly simplistic. I think the kinds of connections that Mike was talking about, he focused on this one circuitry between amygdala and prefrontal cortex. But I think what Mike is also seeing, and he can elaborate on this, is less connectivity in multiple areas of the brain that are very important for bridging parts of the brain that are keeping track of different kinds of information. When I think about conscience, I think about something much more than fear. I think about, like, can I relate to the pain that you might be feeling if you lose some significant portion of your savings? Can I, you know, relate to the terrific aspirations that someone has? I think it's very underappreciated that people with psychopathy are not only fearless and insensitive to threatening negative things, but they also don't seem to really fully appreciate positive things. And maybe for conscience, we're more concerned with the negative things, but actually they seem to be, they process information in a way that's considerably more shallow. And being shallow, I don't think they appreciate the significance of what's going on around them. And so it doesn't have the power to enact some sort of either inhibition or going out of their way to help somebody the way you'd expect of someone with a strong conscience.
You're talking about empathy, too, it sounds
also
like.
Also empathy.
What about the question of youth? Because we know that the brain continues to change, that there's a kind of plasticity about it where you can put down new pathways, and that my understanding is that teenagers, for example, have less in the way of impulse control, and, you know, things are constantly changing. Do you find when you study the psychopaths in the prison system that age has anything to do with what you find?
This is a great point. I think a really key point for what will ultimately be the upshot of this work is to apply it to developing brain to help head off some of these processes as they go astray. So it's important to keep in mind what we have studied so far in the adult prison inmates is the end product, or, you know, something approaching the end product of a lifetime of extremely poor socialization. And so we can't say with certainty that a particular abnormality that we see in the brain is what caused them to be that way, or if rather if it's an effect of the poor socialization.
Or an enhancement. It's a predisposition is already there in the wiring somehow, or the lack of wiring, then the social experience, I mean, like being predisposed to alcoholism. I mean, if you never see alcohol, you'll probably be fine. But if you have, you know, constant mm-hmm. stimuli building that part of the brain.
Yeah, it's true. So what we can do from here, I think, in not just our lab, but in working with other labs that are interested in this topic, is sort of walk back from this picture that we see in the adult inmate and start to, you know, look in adolescents who might be having signs or symptoms that we know are down the road have a higher likelihood of developing into something like psychopathy, and see, can, you know, the neurobiological features help us determine, you know, who's more likely to go down this road versus the other road, and is there a way we can intervene to change the direction?
How far back can you go with that?
Well, that's a great question. So, Joe, do you want
to... Can I just chime in on what you were talking about? Is I think whenever you talk about biological and brain things, there's a tendency to always think this is primary because biology comes before behavior. But I think that one has to be careful here. I think that, you know, when Mike says what we're looking at is a lack of connectivity in the adult psychopathic brain, one possibility is that the evidence here is not that strong, but there's some evidence that a very terrible environment can cause people to shut out the way they process information and actually to become better at ignoring things.
Sure.
And perhaps as a function of that acquired strategy of information processing, those connections become less developed or atrophy. And if the person with psychopathy has some other problem, which I personally think they do, which is an attention-related problem, it can also lead to reduced connectivity throughout the brain. So one of the things that we might see that would be surprising, but I think there's also some budding evidence in this direction, is if we looked at the child, we wouldn't necessarily be looking for the child who has this lack of connectivity. What we might see is that the budding psychopath, as they're sometimes referred to, that this person actually has the connectivity at that point in time, but then shows it less so over time.
So in other words, it becomes sort of shut out as this person becomes hardened somehow.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Again, that's kind of use it or lose it sort of.
Yes.
Or become desensitized. If you have so much horror in your environment, do you sort of stop responding as acutely as someone who isn't constantly around trauma?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just want to mention, too, there's another body of neurobiological work that we can bring to bear on the sort of chicken and the egg question here, and that is a study of neurological patients with focal brain damage. And that's, in fact, how I got to be involved in this at all. So as part of my graduate work, I would study patients who had prefrontal brain damage. And what we noticed about these patients is following their injuries, they would become irresponsible with respect to their, you know, financial decision-making and their social behavior, become detached and estranged from spouses and family and friends, exhibit very little guilt or empathy, very little insight to any of this. The word that behavioral neurologists ascribed to sort of encapsulate that kind of personality change was pseudopsychopathy. Mm-hmm. So in other words, an acquired dysfunction to a particular part of the brain seemed to give rise to something in the direction of psychopathy. And so that's, I think, an interesting angle that we should keep in mind when we're seeing these abnormalities, is that in some cases it very much fits with this neurological literature on personality change. And I think it lends some credence to the idea of what we are observing in this, at least in the case of prefrontal dysfunction, could be something that's contributing to the disorder as an underlying biological cause.
More likely be than a blow to the forehead that would affect the prefrontal ability to function?
Yeah, you could get it through a blow to the forehead. And in a lot of cases, that results in more sort of diffuse injury. I mean, the brain sort of ricochets in the skull and you get sort of shearing of axons and things. But you see it even in cases of, like if there's a tumor that grows in that area of the brain that has to be surgically resected, sometimes stroke or hemorrhage can affect that area of the brain as well. And in fact, that's how Joe and I initially got together. So my research was...
Better explain that.
So blow to the head.
So when I started working here at the university, it was really to explore more basic questions about the neural substrates underlying, you know, emotion regulation, social behavior. And I studied that through these brain damage patients I was describing. But there, like I said, had been this connection made in the literature, although there was never really any direct research, you know, between those two clinical populations. And so upon you know, starting my work here, you know, I was aware of Joe's reputation as this, you know, world leader in psychopathy research. I think I just sent him an email or something, said, do you want to get together for a beer? And like, you know, you can tell me what these psychopathic inmates are really like. And just through those, you know, real informal conversations, we said, well, there's enough here that let's start with just some basic decision-making studies and see if some of the deficits that I've been observing in frontal lobe lesion patients and that Joe has been observing in psychopathic inmates sort of match up and the extent to which they correspond. And we did see enough similarity that we thought, well, let's, you know, if we really want to know what's going on in the brains of these individuals, we have a good guess of where to look. Let's get that data. Let's figure out how to get that done.
And you mentioned attention, Joe, mm-hmm. that there's something also that's different about the response to attention?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it'll help to bring in a personal, well, a case example here. Bob Hare, we've talked about, is such an important person in the field, and he began one of his books with a little example of this person who had participated in his study, but then escaped prison and needed to support himself after he escaped, and he came up with this charity scheme. He was seeking money for this particular cause, and he was terrifically charismatic and very intelligent and very successful at doing that. And he got to make a lot of connections among wealthy people and community leaders, and finally they enticed him to go on television to promote this charity, which he gladly did, and he got on and did a great job. Money just started pouring in following his television appearance, but so did the prison authorities come and pick him up and bring him back to prison.
That sounds
and,
familiar.
It's a funny story, but it shows, I think, this paradox in psychopathy that they seem to have, they have this mask of sanity. They seem completely normal, completely competent. In some ways, they seem super normal and, you know, devoid of the kind of social inhibitions that make some of us awkward. But on top of that is this terrific obliviousness. How is it that somebody so smart can go ahead and think about going on television and not put two and two together
yeah, right.
about what the consequences are going to be? But that really captures what you see in psychopathy. And my approach to the field throughout the entire time I've been here is to try to measure that attention problem in psychopathy. And we see it quite clearly in the laboratory. So we can do things like have them begin gambling games where, you know, you see cards on the screen and you can choose to play them. And in the beginning, you know, almost every time you respond, you win. But the game is rigged so that the longer you play, you start to lose more than win. And you can quit the game whenever you want. And a non-psychopathic offender just about optimally, at the optimal moment, decides, you know, enough of this game. It's going bad. But people with psychopathy, they don't pay attention to changes. You know, they have a positive expectation about this task. They've mastered it. They're winning a lot. And even though they're getting bombarded with negative feedback, they just keep playing. And in fact, they lose all their money.
But is that attention or just being delusional a bit? I mean, because they're paying attention to the gambling.
They're paying attention to the gambling and they're seeing this feedback and then the feedback's not having any influence. They're saying maybe that's delusional. And in fact, back in 1978, when an experiment like that was first done, they called it magical thinking on the part of psychopaths. So I think that was very perceptive on your part. Let me give you another example, though, that my view of the what appears to be magical thinking is due to some sort of attention-related limitation. This experiment's a little bit more complicated, but it's one of the more recent things that we've done, and I think it provides very powerful evidence. Using a very low-level electric shock, which we thought about very long and hard before we could do an experiment like that, but we thought it was crucial to be able to study the fear process since everybody thinks that's the core deficit in psychopathy. We did an experiment involving this electric shock that, you know, just feels like tingling on your finger, but it's aversive. And we arranged these situations so that we tell people right at the beginning of the experiment, when you see a green letter, you're safe. You're never going to be shocked. But if you see a red letter, it means there's some significant chance that you will receive an electric shock. And then we conducted the experiment under, let me just talk about two different conditions. In one condition, we really focused them on the color of the stimulus. We told them, press one button if it's red shocked, press another one if it's green safe. And then we had another condition where we said, well, you notice the letters can either be uppercase or lowercase. Press one letter if it's uppercase. Press another one if it's lowercase. So they know, and in both cases, red is shocked, green is safe. What we found using this measure of fear-potentiated startle is that in the condition where they're focused on the letter case, people with psychopathy showed no fear. they just showed the classic fear deficit, and they were significantly different than the non-psychopathic offenders. But in the condition where we focused their attention on the red color or the green color, they showed as much or more fear-potentiated startle as the non-psychopathic subjects. We've replicated that now three times, and we followed it up with an imaging study where we looked at the amygdala, the structure that Mike was talking about earlier, where people have said that psychopathy is really due to a fundamental amygdala deficit, suggesting that somehow there's a deficiency there that makes them incapable of having true emotion or fear-related responses. What we found in this experiment is when they were focused on the red, they showed amygdala activation that was as great or greater than the non-psychopathic subjects. But again, when we focused them on the letter case, the amygdala activation deficit appears, and you see a significantly lower amygdala activation.
More on psychopaths when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests Michael Koenigs and Joseph Newman, who are telling us about their latest findings in identifying psychopaths and the inclinations of psychopathy. We were just saying that a psychopath has this tendency to persist regardless of any kind of negative feedback in these, you know, gambling games that you mentioned. Might that have a positive side in terms of the persistence and the sort of unemotional disregard for dangers and drawbacks? I mean, sometimes there would be a payoff, wouldn't there?
I think there are in multiple domains. Years ago, I did study the effects of positive and negative feedback, and what you find in non-psychopathic, less impulsive people is that when they get negative feedback, they become inhibited, they lower their expectations for success, and they actually show some depressed affect. But people who are more impulsive and psychopathic, when we give them negative feedback, they don't pause and process it. They actually speed up. And actually, if you ask them what are the chances you're going to succeed in the next trial, they raise their estimate. So in some ways, rather than be deterred by negative feedback, they sometimes are activated and propelled by it. I think there's another side of it that's broader than that, which is that, you know, many of us perhaps don't realize our potential because we're afraid if we take a risk and we fail. And a lot of that has to do with looking forward and feeling thinking about those consequences. What if we fail? We'll lose our fortune. Our family will be disappointed in us. People with psychopathy are probably relatively immune from those things, and some of them might then be more inclined to take the risk and have fabulous success.
What do you think the implications for the legal system and for the medical community would be of the work you're doing?
Well, I guess take a stab at that at first. So one thing that the legal system is starting to pay a lot of attention to is the neurobiological health and neurobiological characteristics of defendants, of criminal defendants. So I recently participated in a Department of Justice-sponsored program in which I actually gave neuroscience lectures to practicing judges at different, you know, regional events around the country. And so I don't think a neuroscientist would say in any principled way that brain science data ought to be used a particular way, or I don't think we have particularly strong feelings about whether, you know, it could be exculpatory or whatever. But the fact is that lawyers are going to try to use it that way, and in fact they have. And so that being the case, it's important for judges and other legal experts to stay abreast of what we are learning about the brains of individuals who are, you know, likely to be in front of them, right, in front of the bench someday.
I suppose there's dangers both ways, because this kind of evidence could be used to keep somebody locked up forever if it looked as if they weren't going to be, you know, capable of being treated, or it could be used to have them also have no responsibility for their actions.
That's true, and there was actually just a really thoughtful article written about that issue, and the title was The Double-Edged Sword, right? So you could imagine a defense attorney, you know, with the image of the inmate's brain and say, you know, look at this client's brain, you know, he can't control what he's doing, he can't be blamed. And then the prosecutor could jump up and say, look at this guy's brain, he can't control what he's doing, you know what I mean? So how this plays out in the adversarial, you know, venue of the court, it will be interesting to see.
That might be a good segue to where this is going. If I can sort of tie back into what I was talking about just before the break about people with psychopathy being completely oblivious to threat cues, things that are associated with electric shocks that they even know about, and that obliviousness putting them at very high risk for antisocial behavior. If that's the problem, and we think it's associated with this lack of connectivity in the brain, what we're a future direction that we're going in, we're trying to get funding for this new program of research, which is to train people with psychopathy to attend to contextual cues in their environment. If the reason they're antisocial is because they're overlooking very important inhibitory cues, what if we could overcome the attention limitation they have and get them to attend to those things? And I guess the way I wanted to tie it into what Mike is saying is I think not only would they then be able to regulate their behavior more effectively, but there's growing evidence that that kind of brain training can sort of repair or remediate some of the lack of connectivity that you see in the brain. So it might not necessarily be the case. In some of the patient cases that Mike has worked with, you know, you have damage to the brain that's not going to be repaired. But if the problem is a lack of connectivity between areas of the brain, and you can train the brain through attention training to connect these areas, then that connectivity might also be overcome, and the brain doesn't have to be seen as limiting the person's potential for adjustment.
That's the thing about the brain. It certainly is endlessly adaptable, isn't it?
Plastic.
Our guests have been Joseph Newman and Michael Kanings. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. And we'll go out with this. He doesn't actually qualify as a psychopath, but he's the most famous Hollywood character who takes the name, Norman Bates, in Alfred Hitchcock's film Psycho. The music is provided by Bernard Herrmann, and this is The Prelude and the Water from the Los Angeles Philharmonic.